So we're ready to begin, and I thought what I would do would be to start with the people here at the front. If any of you have anything you want to add of a personal nature or whatever that you didn't have in your presentation, and we can start with that. If nobody does, we'll start with the audience. But does anybody have anything, or you just want to wait for your questions? Mark probably does.
I don't think I have anything to add.
Okay.
Quick questions from my perspective.
Just a quick reminder that obviously I'm very lucky to have met all of you this weekend. It's been life-changing for me. We are making a documentary. Brandon's back there. It's called LatterdayGloryTheMovie.com. If you want to check out the teaser, and we are accepting donations for the cost of the film, but we're not expecting that. We're very, very, very grateful for all of the people that have approached us interested in being interviewed and telling their stories. So thanks again for the love and support that you've given us.
Thank you. Okay, anybody with a question that was burning through their brain after yesterday? I have one for Max. I'll start. I know you just finished your third book, and you don't like to reveal, you know, a lot, so it doesn't spoil the story.
Ask away.
But from having read the books, I know that your relationship with your parents was very difficult, and I haven't heard you speak too much about what was it like towards the end of their lives. Did you ever reconcile, or did they ever get you? Did they ever really understand you before they were gone?
My dad caught on, this is a tough question this early in the morning. my dad softened after burning himself out on church work. He ended up with, some serious medical problems and learned that family indeed was first. We reconciled. Yeah. My mother, whatever illness she was suffering from, lessened as she grew older, and she softened too, and we had good relationships. Yeah, and then, as far as my father was concerned, I knew that we wouldn't truly reconcile until he died, and saw that the Mormon Church was a piece of shit. Now we can talk. We don't have the church between us anymore. And for 2 weeks after he died, I drove around my neighborhood, my area, in the country of Northwest Jersey, showed him my house. I showed him all my favorite places. I showed him the little Porsche replica that I'd built, took him for rides in that. One day I sat in a parking lot of Lowe's and just yelled at him. And he was okay with that too, he understood. But finally, after his death, it was father to son with nothing between us. And that was just such a feeling of peace. Yep.
You know, yep.
Did you say this morning?
Yeah. This is at 1.2.
Yeah, sure.
A number of people have asked me for my slides. Now, I understand they'll be put up on the Mormon Foundation website. I do have one hard copy here, by the way, of them that I printed out before. So if someone wants those, I'd be glad to pass them on.
The slides will be incorporated into the video that they took, and it goes up on YouTube, Ex-Mormon Foundation
link
channel, and that's where you can find all the talks. We're still working on last year's because we had a real problem. We're afraid that our cameras, with everything that was filmed, were lost, and we finally got a hold of them just about 3 or 4 weeks ago. So they'll go on. Hopefully first, and soon thereafter this year's.
Waving.
Oh. Anybody else?
I hope we ask other people questions too, but I have one for Max also. In your talk last night, you said there was a point where you said you stayed far away from writing, and I can't remember what part of the sequence of your life that was. You probably do, but my question is, did you stay away from writing because you felt like you weren't in the right frame of mind to do it well at that time, or was it a kind of self punishment, if you understand what I mean?
That was during my reinstatement period, and I guess for years after that, that I felt writing somehow had been responsible for my excommunication. Writing made me a bad boy, and I wanted to live as a Mormon again. After I was rebaptized, I stayed in engineering for probably 6 years, and then I simply couldn't subjugate it anymore. It just started coming through, and I found myself angry. I found myself ecstatic as I started to write again. I knew I wasn't that good. I mean, I was coming from engineering school. I could work a fluid dynamics problem, but I couldn't extemporize about literature or writing or anything like that. I sat
That's
in the back of.
I got to say, I'm an engineer too.
Oh, you are.
Yeah.
You're in transition, though, right?
Yes, I am.
That's
trying
great,
to be.
Jeff. That's great. Well, did I answer your question?
Yes, yes, you did.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Probably really wanted to know what's causing his writer's block.
We've talked about that.
Yeah.
We'll be in touch, right?
Okay, so I have a two-part question. First is for these Elf on the Shelf people, and that is, what advice can you give all of us to handle the guilt and frustration of not having as much fun as you guys seem to be having? And then for Jeremy, if you can talk a little bit about maybe some of the thought that went into how you did your excommunication and what you learned from it, and if there's anything you would have done differently or any advice you would give to other people who may see that as a pattern for something that they want to follow.
My best advice is just party harder. That's
yeah.
But in all honesty, just everyone leaving always has rough times. And even though we have a lot of fun, there's plenty of nights when I'm just so frustrated because either my parents aren't getting it, or I mean, right after we left, I had a buddy call me and he told me he saw demons around me and stuff. It was over the phone. I mean, it wasn't FaceTime or anything. So, but it's just like people. It's frustrating. So, you know, we definitely have a good time, but you get what you want to out of life, and we're just trying to focus on the good. So focus on the good when you can, and when there's a shitty day, just drink. I'm just kidding. That's probably a bad idea. But.
No.
You could also get cats.
You guys done?
Yeah, we're
ready. All right, cool. So the answer to your question is I am a very freedom-oriented individual, and I just didn't like the victimization style excommunications that were happening in the last couple of years, like the church has the power and it's taking the power away from the individual. So I just wanted to figure out a way to turn it around, and I think the Flying Spaghetti Monster that you know you came into my life, and by the way, John Streeter came in, and we've spoken over the phone, and he was sharing about like this guy is an expert on the Church Handbook of Instructions, so he's like you know this and this and that and this. I'm like holy shit, and. So what he did was he basically did an inception and planted this idea in my head that I could resign during the court, and I thought that was a pretty cool idea. And so we talked some more about it, and I talked with other people to see if it was actually feasible, and you know, went into the legal stuff in terms of, you know, can they still excommunicate me even though I submit my resignation during the court. So after just going through all the details, I decided I'm just going to go for that. And it was basically my nuclear option that I put in the back of my notebook, just to kind of gauge and feel how it was going, to see maybe if the state president was going to change his mind, actually be honest and follow his integrity. But it became very obvious in that court that that was not going to happen. They were going to excommunicate my ass. And so, like, that room was cold as ice. And when it became obvious that they're just going to go after me, I said what I needed to say, and I just pulled out my resignation letter and handed it over to them. So my advice to people that are facing similar situations, similar kangaroo courts, you have the power. You can resign. And John wrote an excellent article on his website on this topic. The genius behind this strategy is what excommunications are really about is discrediting you. It's ruining your reputation to the Mormon community. This is why the church they have this official policy that it's a private matter. What they want is members to run away with their imaginations as to why you were excommunicated, or it was adultery, or you know what I mean? They just run with their imagination. So the genius behind this strategy is you're going in and you're recording it. You're getting the reasons why they're coming after you. And then you can say what you need to say and walk out. And you have a powerful recording that defends your reputation and your integrity and your character. So it's genius. I highly recommend that. I mean, I didn't invent this. I was like, this is cool. I'm going with it. So I highly recommend that you guys do that, because it turns the tables around on the church. It takes away their power to basically ruin your life. So, does that answer your question?
I'd like to add to that that in the first few years when we finally started getting, you know, the momentum of a lot of people leaving, the advice that I was given and many others was just don't get to the court process. And I think that's why the resignations started happening so quickly. As for me, I know that I didn't want my children that were still in the church to have that one more black mark against me and against the family or whatever. But when you resign, it just takes your power away, and I know there's personal reasons why some people don't, but it's just the whole thing is the power to run your frickin' life all the time, even though you want to go. You know?
Yeah, I just want to add to that. Imagine thousands and thousands of people doing this. It will just make excommunication, you know, ridiculous. Like, you're reframing. Like, you're on a mass scale, you are reframing excommunication as a ridiculous, asinine, retarded process. And that truly takes the a great deal of power away from your church. Like, it's extremely powerful. People don't realize that this is, like, something that if it's utilized on a mass scale, the church will have no weapon against people that question and doubt, and we can really liberate a lot of people by doing that.
If you need any ideas, just wait for the Zelf article, 5 creative stunts to pull at your disciplinary court.
I just wanted to add that I'm actually still considered a member of the church in the eyes of the church, because when I left after my mission, I never went back to revisit the gospel at all. So, in the movie, I will resign from the church as well, which is...
Is anyone unclear about the legal part of what the church can and cannot do to you when you resign or as you're contemplating it? If there is anybody, there's been a court case, which was several years ago now, that once you put that letter in the mail or hand deliver it, they have legally no power. I mean, you do not belong anymore. You have severed your ties. And if they call a court on you and go through with it, they can be sued. And they do know that, of course. They keep up on that stuff. So if you're contemplating it and if there's anything going on at all about your bishop or whatever, I would just get it done because they can't touch you after that.
That stuff they tell you in the email a letter in and they say it's a local matter. You do not have to talk to your bishop. You do not have to have anything to do with anybody ever again, period. And they can't force you to do anything. Or you can. It's your choice. They can't make you. And I was going to, I had a comment for Max. I've been thinking about the excerpt you read last night about the excerpt where Sheikh is word teaching with mm-hmm. that family. And I just love the brilliant way that through this little boy's eyes, you illustrated the pain of the mother, the young, poor mother, and the damage done to the mother and to this boy seeing it and then seeing his father's reaction. You know, in all of those people illustrating the damage through a young boy observing this. I thought that was just so... I can't wait to read the books because it's just a really amazing way to illustrate that harm and how insidious and how many people one little thing affects.
Yeah, it's thank you, Heidi. I had to, I really had to stick with the kid's point of view. But I have a nephew who at the time I wrote the book was about the same age as Sheikh. So I was able to bounce things off of him. How would you react to this? How would you react to that? What does it mean to you what's the difference between being in the world and being of the world? And he had a great answer for that. It was something about being on a bus as a driver or a passenger. I forget exactly what it was, but it's like, thank you. And it went into the book. So luckily I had him to keep Sheikh within his age. There were things about his parents, my parents, that I understand now and can empathize with, but he had no basis for understanding that. And so I had to simply see those people through his eyes as people that were terrifying, as people that he wanted to be loved by, without saying, yeah, his mother's schizophrenic or bipolar or... But thanks. I'm glad the point of view worked for you. And bless your heart for wanting to read. I hope you enjoy.
Hi, guys. My question is with regard to dealing with family members, like your family of origin or your spouse maybe. I want insights on what's worked for you, not just the ones like, was it Jeremy? Did you say you like your dad came around and he's really supporting you? Yeah. What about the people that aren't? How do you balance their toxicity to you, protecting yourself? What's worked? What hasn't worked? That's kind of what I'm looking for. Yeah, you and then everybody else.
So I'm a big fan of the Socrates method. So if you guys have ever YouTube, it's called the 5 minute. It's just the street epistemology, and the idea behind it is you're not lecturing, you're not sharing, you're not getting in a debate or going over the nasty details. You're simply asking very targeted questions.
What if you've already done that? You've gotten nuclear, and now how do you model?
So you're in that phase. It's just love. Even like just saying, I know that we disagree on these fundamentals, but I love you enough to just put that aside and focus on our relationship. And I'm hoping that you can do the same. And just keep it simple, focus on love and empathy and compassion and kindness, all that kind of stuff that we all know about. And just stay away from, you know what I mean? Like, that stuff leads down the road. It may or may not happen. Maybe they'll be interested and want to learn more, or maybe that will never happen. But you have to put yourself in a state where you're okay if it never happens. You're okay if that they'll be Mormon for the rest of your life, for the rest of their life. And you absolutely, unconditionally accept that.
Well,
so.
Sure, I'll just build on what Jeremy said there. I totally agree with that. And the only thing I would perhaps add would be, and how I handle it with, to address you as well, Sue, you know, the two sisters that I have that are, you know, very Mormon, ultra-Mormon, and others, maintain the relationship, which I think is what Jeremy's talking about. I, as I spoke about yesterday a little bit, in balancing the feelings and facts, so I focus on the feelings because feelings are still part of being human, you know, but I will occasionally, where the opportunity comes in, drop a fact to get them to reflect. And they're probably not going to address it, and I'm not going to drill it home too hard because I know they're going to resist that new information that causes a bit of cognitive dissonance, makes them feel uncomfortable, and, you know, that's not the intent. But I drop it occasionally when it's appropriate, where I feel it's appropriate, to get them to reflect. Again, like Jeremy says, though, if, you know, it may have no visible impact, and they may in fact still be Mormons for the rest of their life, and I accept that. And I'm not on a mission, so to speak, to pull them out of the church. But occasionally, I mean, and those, I guess what I'm trying to say is those opportunities actually come quite frequently in life. I just visited with one of my sisters when I was in Alberta in June and her family, and we had a great conversation. For the most part, the topic, I think the church didn't even come up. It's sort of a topic we don't, it's just not on the table. We talk about everything else. But occasionally, there's an opportunity to do so. I just have a nephew, I think I might have mentioned yesterday, called on a mission. He's leaving in January, and better him than me, but you know, nonetheless, I wish him the best. And I sent my sister a quick note saying, hey, listen, you know, don't take this wrong. This is actually sincere, genuine advice. 2 points. One, he's going to face a lot of tough questions, probably more than I did, especially that people are going to Google everything right away now. We didn't have Google in my day. Made things a little easier. So that was point one. And point two was he's doing a service, which whether it's a good service or not, I mean, we may not agree with that, but we can call it a service. Whether he serves 2 years, 1 year, 6 months, 3 months, it's all service. Much like I think I mentioned yesterday, you know, all kinds of different service, military service and others. We just thank them for their service as opposed to shaming them and saying, well, so I guess my point is that I passed on that bit of information. I didn't get a response, but it was simple. It was two quick points. Hey, sister, A, B, done. And I try to insert that occasionally to get them thinking a little bit. So that's how I work it. Did I answer enough of your question there, Sue?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. Just real quick. So we used to, like, machine gunning fat Joseph Smith, you know, marrying 14-year-old girls and all that kind of stuff, latrine, like, move away from that and just ask simple, disarming questions. I read the Trish's essay on you know, polygamy in Nauvoo, and they had a sentence in there about an angel with a sword. I thought that was pretty interesting. I'm curious, from your perspective, what do you think about that? And just leave it at that, you know what I mean? But it depends on the environment, if it's appropriate, and all that kind of stuff. But you get the idea. You're not machine gunning and trying to give them the impression that you're trying to deconvert them. You're just coming from a place of truly wanting to understand how they see the world, how they see these facts. And if you're able to convey that sincerity of wanting to understand their model of the world, it will really go a long way.
So I've had different reactions in my family, and I think the one that's been the best is the ones with my siblings. And my siblings have just basically been absolutely accepting, completely loving, and just trusting that I'm still a good person. And it hasn't been a big deal. And I think part of the reason why that's been successful with my siblings is because I've never gone to my siblings and been like, what about this? What about this? Have you seen this? Have you seen this? What about this? What about this? And I've kind of come to this point where I've realized they have given me the space to live my life how I want to live my life. And they deserve to have that for me as well. Because I know they completely disagree with me, and I completely disagree with them. But we have that mutual respect where we just don't go there. There's this Michelle Obama quote where she says, when they go low, we go high. And I think that's absolutely the best approach, is just beat them at their own game. You know, just be the more Christ-like person in every situation that you can, when you can be. You know, stand up for truth, but always approach it with love.
I also think if you just frame things in a way that's like, you know, the church just doesn't align with my moral compass, or like I can't justify Joseph Smith having 14-year-old wives, and just it's like feelings based, so you can't really argue with it. But it also gives you like a little opportunity to change the narrative a little bit, because it's all just about what you find like morally acceptable or not.
I'm not sure that my mom, who has been a member since I was 5 years old, has ever even read the Book of Mormon fully. So to use any factual evidence isn't going to really work with her. She's very much a faith-based person. That being said, like, we did have a lot of very tough times after me coming out of the closet and leaving my mission. And I think in observing my past, especially right after my mission, the first few years, I wasn't living... Heidi said it very well. She hates when people shit all over themselves emotionally. And I was shitting all over myself because I didn't think I had any worth. So I was behaving in ways that were not healthy for me. Now that I look back, I realize that my mom necessarily wasn't just disappointed that I wasn't a member of the church. She was like very scared that I wasn't going to have the healthy and easy life that she had had as a straight woman. You know, so now... purely by observation and time, she's learned that I've learned to take care of myself well and treat myself with dignity. And she is there observing that and realizing that, okay, this guy can be in love, get married, and have a happy, healthy life for the rest of his life. So she's supportive of it, even though there's not really a chance of saying Joseph Smith screwed 14-year-olds. What do you think about that? She would be like, well, if Jesus told him to. So...
it's funny how normally, you know, people in the world, they'll say, the devil made me do it. It's only Mormons who say, Jesus made me do it.
Mine is for Mark. It's a little bit specific, so sorry if it seems a little individual, but it's on the same vein. I find when we're dealing with Jared's family, who is the family that is Mormon, and just so in case anyone knows, I've never been Mormon myself, but it seems like a technique. I'm not sure if it's a technique or if it's just kind of a mechanism that they use as a family or if it is from the church, but something they do really tips me over, and I kind of have to end the conversation unless I want to get really mean, which is what I don't want to do, is they'll say something along the lines of, it sounds like you're accusing us of being intolerant, but it feels like that's what you're doing. And then what I need to be able to convey to them is that they're really skirting our question for them and making us defend ourselves. And it makes us feel like we're digging our heels in, and it has nothing to do with us. Mormonism doesn't have anything to do with us. All we're talking about is the way that we are being treated. It doesn't matter if they're Mormon. It doesn't matter if, you know, they're an exclusive country club or they're a soccer team or they're a school. But I'm wondering if you have any sort of unpacking techniques for something that is really communication-based. Like it is, you know, something, another example specifically was around, I can't remember what Trevor said, but he used the same technique, but a very different context. And so it's I don't even know if it is passive aggressive or if it is like a protective piece on their part, but we don't want to go into that defensive mode of ourselves. So I'm just wondering if there's anything very specifically you can suggest.
Sure. My thoughts are, you know, when we're talking feelings and facts and the balance of the two are just that, you know, involved in everything we do in life, really. And when we make decisions, we use a combination of head and heart, which really are feelings and facts. You know, conversations are going to have a combination of those in them. And what I would suggest, if it works, is that you sort of, you mentioned unpack and, you know, sort of separating those. What I'll often say is, okay, if you want to talk about feelings, let's do that, and we'll keep facts out of it for now. I think an important part of feelings is mutual respect, and this needs to be, you know, a cordial conversation. So let's respect each other's feelings. Or if you want to talk facts, we can have that, but I think the ground rule there is mutual respect again. But it's that, you know, facts, as I think I mentioned yesterday, they can stand up to any level of scrutiny. So we can't sort of, we can't jump back to feelings, testimonies, or anything else, because we're talking facts here. Just one thing that comes to mind. Now, they're very likely going to want to talk, you know, feelings, but then you've got that ground rule either way, is what I'm saying, okay? You know, and the other thing, too, that you can work in there is the reality piece, okay? I mean, feelings are wonderful, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that feelings aren't real, they are, but, you know, feelings can skirt around all kinds of facts. So at some point, what I guess I'm saying is you can separate those conversations, but you may want to move over to have that factual conversation if they're willing to do it, if that's where you're sort of want to move things. But sometimes, you know, I think it's just, it's simply, you have to just respect each other's viewpoints. My mother, when she resigned a few weeks ago, she was quite concerned about, you know, the pushback she might get from the members of the family that are ultra-Mormon. Two of my siblings in particular, and being a, you know, a public affairs guy, I offered to be her spokesperson. I typed up her letter. I even put in the letter that my mom really didn't want to discuss it, and if the bishop wished to have any questions, he was to call me, and yet she did. I was quite surprised, and I was quite blunt with him as to why she was resigning. It certainly was some feelings, but it was that the church, in my opinion, was a fraud, and she didn't want to be part of it anymore. He kind of went silent, and that was the end of it. But with respect to sisters, we sort of did the same thing. And my mom said to my sisters, "Look, I have my life, and you have yours. And if you want to carry on being Mormon, that's fine. I don't wish to. If you wish to, you know, sort of get into any detailed conversation on why I'm leaving, just call your brother Mark. I haven't received a call." Because I think they know I, like most of us, can talk the issues fairly well there. So, you know, when I was over at one of my sister's house in June, we talked feelings, we talked life, and if we did talk facts, it was, you know, what's in the news, okay? But I'm willing to move to facts at any point, as long as we, you know, as long as we don't jump back to feelings, okay? We're going to talk facts here. Let's, for the next 15 minutes, talk facts on this issue. Let's scrutinize it. Let's break it down. And very, you know, let's face it, with most of those issues, very quickly, they're not going to feel comfortable because the facts don't support them. You know, the history, whether we're talking archaeology of the Book of Mormon or, you know, all a myriad of things in the Mormon Church that just don't factually line up historically and otherwise. So at some point, they're going to want to move out of that conversation. And the thing I have to tell myself is you don't have to win that discussion, okay? Because, I mean, you know, it's very tempting to want to, you know, crush the opposition and finish it up. But it's all you really need to do is plant this, I think. You know, when they give you the whatever, or they move back to feelings or to a different topic, you've made your point, I think. So is that help? I hope that's helpful.
But yeah, definitely. Thank you.
So my question has to do with nieces and nephews reaching out to me. How do I handle that? Because it's come to a point where I've gotten in a lot of trouble, and so there's this, and I never contact anyone myself, but I have them contact me and talk about wanting to cut themselves after church and being suicidal after church. So they're reaching out to me, and I have now said that I won't communicate with them, but that feels really crappy too. But But parents feel like I'm going behind backs, and I'm not. I'm not ever contacting anybody. They're reaching out to me. So how do you handle this? How do you handle family relationships where you're seen as a safe person from nieces and nephews that are breaking down and having a really hard time, and the parents are like livid that I'm happy and that I'm living life the way I am because I'm a bad example to their kids? I don't know. How do I handle that?
How old are your nieces and nephews?
Everywhere from almost 30 to really young. So the ones that are reaching out are 25 to 16.
Okay. So I have an aunt who left the church just decades ago. And she's kind of been ostracized by the rest of my mom's family. And she's the only relative that I think me and Samantha both feel comfortable hanging out with. And she is great. And that is a lifesaver for us. And she seriously is just, it's when you feel like all of your family doesn't get it, to have that person that does get it is a huge deal. I think she's gotten crap from my mom. I think my mom's kind of been upset that we go see her and that she's to open and talks with us. And I think that the rest of the family probably feel the same way. And so I don't want to pretend to know what your situation is, but if you can be there for them, it's a huge deal for them, and it's a huge deal for me. So I recommend being there for them.
Thank you. Yeah, you're going to obviously get drama from some of your family members because you're there as a support system, but it's beneficial to those people very much. So when I was about 23, I had worked in Seattle. My mom called me and asked me to move to St. George, Utah. I was already way out of the church at that point, but she told me my little sister was cutting herself. And I really didn't know in depth what that meant and how severe that was. And it wasn't until about a month ago when Brandon and I went to Seattle when I was visiting my family that my sister overheard Brandon interviewing me for our little teaser video. And Brandon was like, "Do you know anybody that has attempted or committed suicide because of being LGBT and having grown up Mormon?" And I was like, "I don't." And my sister, who was in the living room with my niece, literally just went, "Does it count if I cut myself?" And I was like, I forgot that was something that she'd suffered with because she never really communicated with me about that. So even though I wasn't fully aware of how much I was helping by just being present and moving, I did move to St. George for a year and stayed with my family. I kind of lived in a tent in the backyard. It really helped her out to have her big brother that had always been there as a kid. I moved out, you know, before she had graduated high school. So I left her side as a little kid, but I was always doing her hair and makeup, and I was always that brother that, like... Shocking, isn't it?
It's my career.
Anyway, to be there for support for them, no matter everybody else's point of view, is a great thing. And last night I talked to a couple people individually. I had gone to a therapist for a period of time that I don't even know how to express this necessarily. Like, I was expressing to her my sadness for disappointing everybody around me. And for those of you that feel like you're disappointing your family, it's a heavy, heavy feeling, obviously. Well, she made me recognize that it didn't necessarily matter whether or not I was disappointing them, because for the first time in my life, I was actually truly standing up for myself. And so if you continue to do that and stand up for your nieces and nephews, they're going to recognize eventually that even though they're disappointing their parents or your sisters or brothers, that they're doing something genuinely for who they are and what they need.
I just want to say I'm having a really kind of strong reaction to this story, and I just, as someone who's never been a part of the church, I just feel like I need to say, people trying to hurt themselves is not even close to as important as Mormonism. Nothing at all is more important than someone trying to hurt themselves or take their lives. And I'm not sure if it's just because I've never been a part of it, and I don't mean to be insensitive, but Jonathan and I did talk about this a little bit last night. stop thinking about how you're making them uncomfortable and start thinking about how they're making you uncomfortable and how they're hurting people. They're killing people. This is people's lives, and it's just, it's not okay for any reason. And it's even worse if it's in the name of religion. And I'm sorry, I'm shaking. Like, go find your nieces and nephews and do whatever it takes to help them. And if someone doesn't come around eventually and isn't disappointed in you, like, can't stop being disappointed in you for that, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if you're helping someone, because nothing should matter more than helping someone, if they're in your family or not, but they need you. And I don't mean to be bossy, but holy cow. Please run and help them as soon as you can.
I don't think I came here knowing why I was open to making this movie at all, other than needing to maybe retell my story. And I mean, for many of you who don't know, like, right after, I think after coming out of the closet, after leaving my mission, getting kicked off my mission, not leaving, with an honorable discharge for mental illness, I didn't realize at all that I was going to be able to share my message and it would affect other people. I just needed to give it to myself and tell my story, because I've been digging it so deep for so many years. It's smoking weed so I don't have to think or feel, and not being able to cry when my boyfriend's sad or acknowledge my emotions. And now I recognize I'm not just doing it for that, I'm also doing it for every single little kid out there that was me or is me now. Can't let them hurt themselves, no.
And I'd like to just mention, just to build on that, but from a communications perspective, I mean, that angers me, and I'm sure it may some of you as well, when I hear that you were released, you know, from mental illness. You know, sexual orientation is certainly, there's no link there, and yet they're framing that, they're trying to communicate that, they're trying to sort of load the language in a way. And I think that's where, individually and collectively there needs to be pushback. Through what we talked about yesterday from a communications perspective, because, you know, I don't know, that was 16 years ago, and certainly there's been a lot of progress in some domains, some might argue, in terms of how people view, you know, sexual orientation, but there needs to be pushback on that, and there is, because for them to, in the year 2000, equate that is quite shocking. You know, maybe not so much in 1700, but it wouldn't be as shocking. But I think it's really important that there's pushback, like I mentioned yesterday about the word apostate and how I pushed back on that and pointed out that, you know, there's not a lot of converts nowadays in North America, but nonetheless, you know, the converts that they do have were members of other religions, and therefore they had apostatized from wherever they were to become Mormons. And the individual I was talking to didn't really like that, but yeah, I think they saw it in a bit of a different viewpoint, and I think we really need to push back on anyone, the Mormon Church or anyone else for that matter, that's trying to equate, you know, mental illness there. I think that's pretty twisted.
So, given the field I'm going into as therapist in training, the very first we do is safety. People have to be safe, and your relatives are not safe, and they need to be safe. And it doesn't matter if it even destroys relationship with the siblings, but you know they're hurting, and people cut because they're in so much pain and they don't know what to do, and it relieves the pain. Most of them are not intending to kill themselves, but sometimes they kill themselves on accident. The kids where I work, 80% of them have had multiple suicide attempts. And some of them have cut themselves just to relieve pain, to the point that they go too deep, they nick an artery, they bleed out. It happens. It's dangerous. And like she said, they're killing people, they're hurting people. And Mormons can't see it. you can see it. They aren't even going to see that their kids are really, really in danger and their kids are scared to tell them they feel like cutting themselves, but they're telling you because they need help. And the Mormons have their tribe. They have what they need. These kids don't. That's why they're telling you. And it's serious. So number one, always, everybody. They can be furious. You don't actually have to talk to them.
What is the conversation? How do you frame that when you're talking to the parents and say, because I mean,
I can give you a little, I'm not going to say from my words, but I remember my psychologist, who was not Mormon at all, expressing to me that the best way to explain to my mom the challenges that I had was to use the metaphor of my brother who was in the military and serving a tour of duty in Afghanistan. And she was like, it's equally as dangerous for him as it is for you. He might be physically at war, but you're also at war all the time. And so to express, in my mind, using a metaphor of some sort is going to help them recognize, maybe via another child or another situation that they've been in, the one that they're currently in and the stance that, that your nieces and nephews take and the reason that they're taking that. You know, that you're in a battle mentally, emotionally, psychologically. You don't have a connection to spirituality anymore. You're just fighting with yourself and cutting yourself or doing whatever it is to lower the demonization of who you think you are because the church told you that.
Church has something in place meaningful to address his concerns or her concerns. I'm going to be there for it. Until you, my sister, have something in place meaningful to address his or her concerns, until he would rather come to me than come to you, I'm going to be there for them. When you do have something meaningful to where he's going to go to you, then I'll keep my peace. That's my answer.
Sue, can I just say one?
Perhaps you can. Is it working? Oh, I can't tell. That's funny. It's my hearing aid. Sorry. Perhaps you can even be more basic than that, and say to this, whoever's calling you and saying, hey, what the hell do you think you're doing talking to my son or whatever, you could put it as basic as, look, when someone seeks my help, I'm going to respond. I'm coming from a place of love.
And that's what I've done.
Sue, just before that moves on this question, I think some great responses there, and obviously the individual support and the counseling is a very important. That's not my area of expertise. More broadly, from a communications perspective, I think this type of thing needs to continue to be exposed through media or otherwise, because let's face it, I think Mormons and the rest of the world, the majority of that are not Mormon, really don't have much of an idea. They read about it occasionally, but there's no depth. And I think with more exposure of, this type of thing and the risk that some young people and others are at, and you know, the equating of, you know, mental illness with sexual orientation, the majority of the world sees that as kind of crazy and very upsetting, you know, when we talk about your situation there. And I think that if that's more broadly communicated, that, and there's a better understanding, that kind of support comes from above, and not just in, you know, externally and not just internally, and it strengthens the overall position.
We have had nieces and nephews reach out to us, have their 10 children in the family, and their parents know that one of them's out, but seven of them are now. We're the only safe place they have, and that's why they've reached out to us. And their father got very upset with me. He and I, he was my best man. We're very close. I love him dearly. He's retired from CES, uber Nazi Mormon. And he did get upset with me, and he accused me of trying to steal his children. But his response to them was, you know, angry, we'd rather you were dead than out of the church, things like that. And I said, I do this because I love them because I loved you first. And I love your children, and I'm going to be a safe place for them because I lost a son to suicide, and I know what that is like. And so he finally has backed off, and he told me once, oh, I'm glad you're there for them. You know, I wish it was different, but I'm glad they have you to go to. And they do. They call us all the time. One of them, I didn't know they were out. They didn't know I was out. One of them saw me comment on John DeLynn's Facebook and texted me and said, I saw your comment, and I went, oh, crap. But guess we should talk, and then, you know. So, but I just told them, I do this because I love them. They're all adults. They can choose and who they talk to, and I will be a safe place as long as they need one. That's all.
I think it's time we get off the get out of the defensive position, and it's like we can't fight back, you know, or something. And you can say something like, "Hey, I understand where you're coming from, but that's your problem, not mine," and leave it with them, and not own that, and not get defensive. But I have a question for Mark. In a month, one of the most horrendous policies the church has ever came out, the November policy. And it was found and put out there by John DeLynn. And then Elder Christofferson came on and tried to do reparative therapy, I guess, for everything, and used the word policy 9 times in his video. And then, what, a month later, Elder Nielsen said something about it being the mind of the Lord and the will of the Lord. And then now the latest thing is, you know, people have talked with Elder Holland, and when they do the reprinting of the Bishop's Handbook, it's going to be gone. And do you know how that angers me? Because this last year, the suicides that have resulted because of that policy, what is this PR run amok? What is going on?
Well, I mean, yeah, I was horrified last year, 11 months ago, when I heard of that, like everybody else. You know, they, with respect to the PR, the communications management of it, I think they've, you know, I've given them a mixed mark on that, and not judgmental, but in just terms of the professional communications perspective. But they're dealing with extremely difficult issues, and certainly if they're flip-flopping on that policy, which I think you're suggesting, I haven't heard that, but if they are in fact going to pull it back, I think that would be wonderful. Yeah, now, you know, how are they going to do that? Now, when that came out, it was leaked from someone through John DeLynn, I understand. I don't think that was their intention. I think they were planning on doing what I referred to in one of my slides covered, sort of a soft blend. In other words, a change, and then sort of, oh, it's always been like that, and slowly change the supporting material and church handbooks and otherwise to go there, and then they were sort of taken back. And then I think they really tried to tidy up the issue. And which is not uncommon in communications, and that's why you saw President Nielsen coming out, probably leaning a little far forward to suggest that it in fact was the word of the Lord. And right Now, the problem with that, of course, I think, is that now that makes it, that firms up their position, makes it sort of a revelation in their view, and that makes it a little tougher to come back from. But, I mean, good communications people will work that. It's just a little more difficult because everything's documented nowadays. You know, everything's out there. So, it can be called back. The bottom line is this. You know, communications is there to support operations, so to speak. And if, in fact, they're going to pull that back, great. You know, I've predicted for a long time, as have others, that there will be a revelation, coming in the next 5-10 years or so, where all will be accepted. I'm talking primarily from a sexual orientation perspective, because I think public opinion and just with, if you look at the polls and public opinion within millennials, I think it'll force it, which is what surprised me 11 months ago, because I thought we were going in a soft blend or transition towards that, and then suddenly they came out with that ruling. But they may realize that was a mistake. They'll never admit it, probably, and then softly transition back from a communications perspective, and it'll cause them all kinds of grief because there's all kinds of things on the record, including the statement from President Nielsen last January, I think, that they'll have to work around and maneuver around. The reality, of course, though, is they'll just resort to, support the prophets, don't ask tough questions. These are the answers you'll have after this life, you know, the usual answers that answer any question. So bottom line, though, is this. Communications, you know, it's my passion, but really it's secondary. You know, who cares about the communications if they actually pull the policy back? Bonus, right?
So, just as example, my mom is a believer that exists because of confusion in the household from the children, which is what she's been taught, right? And I feel like very recently I gave her first aha moment when I said, well, you know that I'm going to get married to Kai, my partner. She's ecstatic about it. And I said, you know, we want to have kids. She's ecstatic about it. And I said, well, what if my kid wants to go to church with you? I'm going to allow that because I love my mom and I know that she would be ecstatic to have her grandchild go to church on occasion. I was like, well, what if my 14-year-old daughter wants to get baptized and has been going to church with you and enjoys the gospel and decides, and I give her free will as my child to do so, not that I would support it necessarily, my child wouldn't be able to get baptized and go to church with you regularly and feel like a normal member. And that was the first time that she was like, oh, that doesn't feel good to me. So.
Sorry to go twice, but Mark, I'm interested because we think of the church and the big PR machine that they have now and everything. When you look at church history, like what sort of rating do you give Joseph Smith as a PR communicator handling all the controversies? Like when you look back on what he did and how that worked, like how do you see it from a PR communication perspective?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've never really thought about PR in terms of Joseph Smith. I don't think it was as big an issue back then because I think information traveled much more slowly. So you could say something crazy and it wouldn't be all over the world in a matter of minutes like it will be today. So those kind of things, you know, sort of would seep out slowly and you'd have all kinds of opportunity to deny that unless you actually had witnesses, and even then maybe the witnesses were delusional, who knows, right? So, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on Joseph Smith. From what I do know in my readings and studies and, you know, observations is he was certainly charismatic. He was certainly very influential, but like many, what I refer to as, you know, mild cult or other cult-ish leaders, you know, he had other desires, sexual and monetary and perhaps others as well. But I just don't think he had to manage the issues in the same way that are necessary today. And I think, in recent decades, the church has been, you know, sort of taken back by the pushback they have gotten, and they've had to develop a PR machine. Quite a powerful one, quite a good one. And when I say good, not that I'm saying that the what they're putting out is good, but their management of issues, when you look at what they're managing, is you know, it's quite remarkable. It's why I wanted to pop by. And, I mean, I was a little bit in awe at sometimes at some of the issues they deal with, right? But to answer your question from a PR perspective, dealing with a much smaller world, You know, you like today, things just wouldn't happen like that today. You know, you send missionaries over to England to bring people back, and you tell them that there is no polygamy, even though they've heard rumors, and they really have no way of substantiating it, and they don't find that out till they're over in Utah, and they haven't got any money or ability to get back to England, and so guess what? You know, they join and away they go. That wouldn't happen today. You know, with the internet and all the in the information age, you know, so it's two completely different eras. I think, I mean, when I go back in my PR days, I mean, in my early days very early days was just either pre-internet or on the edge of the internet, you know, so we weren't dealing with the extent of web communications and online communications that we are today. And there was disadvantages to that, but there were certainly advantages. You could get away with things that you couldn't, you just cannot today, and no doubt Joseph Smith and other church leaders did.
Yeah. It's easier to destroy a printing press than the internet.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
Very good point. So kind of on that same vein, I want to say thank you to each one of you. One of my key takeaways from this conference is that each of you has come to this group and shared your gifts and talents with us, whether it's this amazing sense of humor and videography and amazing topics that you YouTube, to insights and really thought-provoking questions, even introducing us to some of the communication skills and some of the things that are going on in public communications that when you take a step back and you can say, oh, this is actually a science, and you realize that it isn't inspired. It's actually very corporate, and what they're doing is being done in all sorts of organizations. You can kind of take some of the emotion out of it and to share painful stories and being able to share that perspective of looking back and being able to take those lessons from it and just helping us understand other perspectives and appreciating and loving each other for just who we are. I just want to say thank you. What do you see over the course of the next year? What are some of the things that you predict in the future that we'll be discussing this time next year with each other?
My whole life's going to change.
Very much so.
Everyone, I would love to hear from each one of you, actually. What do you think?
Prophesy, is that what it is?
Yes. Or forecast.
I'm going to need 10% of your income.
For you, I would give it.
I'll do it for 8.
Yeah. When I decide to
do
something,
4%.
Generally speaking, when I decide to do anything, whether it's career, love, everything I do, I don't really use logic. I just come up with weird ideas and jump off a cliff head first and hope that I don't even hope. I know that I have to swim because I don't give myself a choice. Either I'm going to fail completely, which I don't allow myself to do, or swim hard and succeed at it. So I think this time next year, because it's my first time meeting every single one of you, I'm going to have a new family of people that I understand and love and receive love from, which is amazing, and hopefully stand up here next year in support of these people and maybe speak and tell my story again or something like that. My whole life is changing, that's for sure.
I guess I second everything that Jonathan said. Practically speaking, can you hear me? Okay, I can't hear much. Practically speaking, I will have book 3 out. Practically speaking, I will have the third book of the 4-book series out. It'll be called Instrument of the Lord. It's a story of Sheikh on his mission and going through the story I told you yesterday. So,
With respect to, I think your part of your question was where do you see the church going in the next, you know, 5-10 years or issues surrounding it. We've had some interesting discussions this weekend on this. I think there's going to be a continuation of certainly large number of resignations. We don't know that number. We can only estimate it because the church doesn't release it, which from a communications perspective is probably smart on their part, because I'm pretty sure it's a large number. So that's going to continue to dig into the church revenues and church numbers and support for sure. But the church was, sorry?
Do you know Mark Nagel?
I've heard the name.
He's a lawyer in Salt Lake.
Oh, yes, yes. He's the one that helps, yes, yes.
Good.
Okay. Well, yeah, they're high. I know we're in the tens and tens of thousands. Yeah, I know it's a lot. I see the church was able to, you know, because of Brigham Young and the westward trek, was able to get decades and decades of building themselves strength wise, numbers wise, that, you know, just wouldn't happen today. But that's history. So they've got a very strong established base, and they're worth billions and billions. And as I've said to a few people over the weekend, for that kind of money, you can buy a lot of truth, not a lot of reality, but you can buy a lot of truth, and you can buy an awesome communications machine. You can put huge amounts of money into web and online communications, which they do. And so for that reason, I see the church around for quite a long time. However, with communications and on, you know, everything online nowadays, it's going to be countered. And I think their narrative is going to have to change significantly. I think over the next few years, they are going to have to back off on a number of things. And if they don't pull, for example, the fiasco gay policy from last November, they'll just stop talking about it. Because another way, sometimes organizations, they don't necessarily cancel, you know, hold a news conference or put out a press or news release and cancel something. They just sort of tuck it in away and don't talk about it anymore. That way they don't have to announce it, but they don't get they get far less bad publicity. And I think you'll see a lot, I think that's what you're going to see, not only with that issue, but with a number of other controversial issues.
I'm noticing that the conversation is changing. More and more people are talking about doubts, especially in the church. There's more acceptance of the facts. Yes, Joseph Smith used a rock and a hat to translate the Book of Mormon. Like, it's no longer an anti-Mormon lie. It's a fact. So that's a really fascinating thing that's going on. Another thing I'm noticing is in the apologetic world, you have guys like Patrick Mason saying, like, he's acknowledging the facts, and he's, like, we're moving away from a fair Mormon, McDonald-style apologetics to a Richard Bushman, the dominant narrative. It's not true. It can't be sustained. We have to reconstruct the narrative. So that conversation is very fascinating. So combine this with the emergency of all these suicides happening, all these PR disasters. I just see this big train wreck coming within 5 years. I mean, I just don't see this circus being sustainable. I just see this cloud just, so.
I may be the oddball here, but I think this year we're finally going to get all that archaeological evidence we've been hearing so much about. Maybe some DNA evidence. I really think so. On a serious note, I was talking about this last night. I think this will be the year that we discover whether Elder David A. Bednar is secretly a lizard person in disguise or a robot in disguise.
I think with a lot of young people, they, like the younger generations don't have the same obsessiveness, it seems, about the church. Like when we told Connor's siblings we were leaving, they were able to be very accepting of that. And the narrative now is like, just love people. And that wasn't necessarily the case in practice in the past. So I guess, I mean, people are obviously going to keep leaving. I feel like we've been treated since we left the church. There's been so many big PR scandals since we left. It's like every few months there's a new thing, and there's tons of people leaving and tons of people messaging us saying that they have all these doubts. And yeah, so I guess it's just going to keep on being a shitstorm. That's going to be exciting to watch.
I think, at least as the next year goes, I feel like the church has tried to like create two different versions of the gospel. There's like the one for the older generation that like grew up through like the, you know, the good old days, and I think there's.
It's like we have a Frankenstein church.
Yeah,
like seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah. He used to go place to translate the Book of Mormon. Well, he used the rock in a hat. You know,
yes.
Like, we have this really weird Frankenstein situation.
Absolutely. And so that's the thing. If I'm talking to my friends from high school, and if I'm talking to my like priest quorum leader from when I was, you know, a priest, it's just a completely different conversations, right? And I think the church is going to keep trying to move towards that way because they can't really back away from the truth claims because, hey, all the stake presidents are going to freak out, but they can't hold on to them because all the next generation of leaders knows that those things are not necessarily how it's been presented. And so I think there's going to continue to be more vague, just love messages at General Conference that everyone can feel like it feels good. And they'll keep having, you know, like these essays on the internet for the millennials to find, but they'll be buried so that way the older generation doesn't have to worry about, you know, their worldview. And so I think it's going to keep being this like kind of.
And I would totally agree with that. They've really got two different audiences, and it's extremely tricky, and you hit it right on the head with the truth piece. I mean, you know, I talked yesterday about, you know, and we've referred to most organizations, how they do the communications, and the church is just another organization, and very corporate at that. But they are stuck with that, you know, traditional narrative of you know, Joseph Smith and the restored gospel, and we're the only true church. And they really can't jump off that for the reasons you've mentioned, you know, with the millennials and the younger people and where they're moving in terms of the things they're putting out. So they can't really move off that in the way that would allow them to communicate like many other organizations. They can't sort of step out and sort of acknowledge that directly. They can, but, you know, the old guys are not going to do that. So that's a very good point. The money, the big money, most of the big money is with the folks that aren't as young. And so let's face it, it is all based on money. But a comparison might be in, you know, 1890 to 1904, after the declaration or revelation on canceling polygamy, which was very much influenced by, of course, the U.S. Army on the edge of Utah threatening to seize all their property. But I digress. You know, at that point, I mean, they even today, but at that point, they had to transition between, you know, the way it was polygamy was the way, the celestial principle to a new principle, and they were dealing with two audiences in doing that. Now they've somewhat successfully, I mean, more than 100 years ago, you know, got past that, and I think now with all the issues and as Jeremy mentions, the seer stone and the old truth and the new truth, it's a very tricky maneuvering game that they're playing right now to retain as many members and as much revenue as they can. They recognize, there's no doubt in my mind that in their board meetings, they recognize they're going to take a hit. They're just trying to minimize that hit through good management, well, relatively speaking, and good communications.
I love how you call it board meetings.
Yeah.
Very corporate.
I have a question. I appreciated what you were saying about pushing back on the word apostates. And so, speaking of glorious apostates, my question is for Zelf on the Shelf. I want to know how you would handle that in the manner that you do things, the word apostates, because I'm sure you've run into that, and how you would handle that.
I actually have a different opinion on that. I fully embrace the term apostate. I think... and it's different for everybody, so I'm not saying that this is the right answer for everyone, but for me, it's easier for me to own a label and reshape in their mind what that label actually means rather than trying to get them to change their label. So I say, yeah, an apostate is by definition someone who leaves their belief, and that's exactly what I am. So I'm an apostate, but I'm also happy, and I'm also a good person. And so rather than trying to just change the whole story, I just change the way that they see it, and I fully embrace that.
According to a meme I found on the internet, and I just double-checked it with Google, apostate comes from the Greek for escaped slave. So maybe that makes you feel better about the whole thing.
Hey, just real quick, with the Game of Thrones, for those of you that watch it, what's his name? Is it Tyrion? Anyway, he Peter says, Dinklage. You know the you know the little person in Game of Thrones? Yeah. So he says, never forget what you are. The rest of the world will not. Wear it like armor, and it can never be used to hurt you. So if you embrace, like you're an apostate, and to you, being apostate means you're a truth seeker. And you, if you frame it that way, yep. and just own it, they can't hurt you. I mean, the reason why they're big on that word is they're trying to hurt you and intimidate you. And if you take that away, they don't have that weapon.
And I wouldn't disagree with that if that's what the ex-Mormon community feels is important. Exactly. You can reframe it. But keep in mind, we're dealing with two audiences here.
Totally.
Internal, which is, you know, our the Mormon community, active or inactive, and then the rest of the world, okay? And so in doing that, I wouldn't disagree, but you'd have to look at, you know, you'd have to look at what the word, you know, and what the impact of the word apostate has externally, and before you sort of made a decision, perhaps. But looking at more broadly from a communications perspective, but certainly that's another way of approaching it, is just to soften how people see and how they look at the word apostate. You can reframe that for sure.
I like definitions that like actually work. I think a lot of labels are misunderstood. Like the word atheist, you tell someone you're an atheist, and they're like, "Oh, that you think you can prove that there's no God?" It's like, that's not what it means. It just means I don't have a belief in God. So helping clarify terms, and sometimes the terms aren't correct. Like if someone calls me a core whore, I say what my friend Richard Tripp says and say, "Core whore don't got shit on me." That's not a good label because I don't relate with him. His arguing was really bad, and I think I can do better than Cora Horse. So don't use that term, but sorry, Joe.
Okay, so Joe Rollins, author of the Cora Horse argument. I also mentioned in the Cora Horse argument that I could have argued it better, so no offense taken. This question is for Jeremy and then also for Mark. I'd like to talk about like our image problem as ex-Mormons. Obviously, people leave Mormonism. They go to all walks of life. A lot of us come to atheism or some kind of agnosticism, but a lot of people don't. So our message is a little more scattered, I think, and we kind of let the church paint who we are in just by necessity, just by the fact that we're by nature as filthy apostates, those of us who wear it proudly. We're disorganized, you know, and they are extremely organized and funded. But specifically, I was really inspired by Lyndon Lamborn, and the reason why I recorded my Court of Love to show other people somebody does stand up. Because, you know, when I heard Lyndon Lamborn's recording of his excommunication, I thought, wow, people actually do still do that. Of course, it was happening all the time, but if you're not hearing it like people hear mine or more importantly, yours, Jeremy, you know, they're getting a dose that there are people who stand up to the church, and we totally respect those who resign. That's, you know, of course. But there are those who will stand up at a court of love and defend themselves. And does it help, this is my question, does it help to just repeat the same laundry list about who Joseph Smith had sex with and who he stole money from, et cetera, or is it better from an image standpoint for people who do have go through the excommunication process or release or record it in any ways to be more honest and personal and intimate? What would you advise to those people who are out there right now thinking, I'm going to go through the court of love, I'm going to do something public, you know, what can they do that would be better for the message and image of ex-Mormons?
Great question. The nature of court of loves is hostile. Like, they're coming after you because you're speaking out about your doubts and concerns. So a natural consequence of that is to bring up the issues that, you know, I have a concern that Joseph Smith married 14-year-old and all that. So I don't see you being able to get away from that just by the very nature of the court and the charges that are being placed against you. So, for example, in my court of love, one of the charges against me was I was speaking against the prophet Joseph Smith. I was attempting to discredit the prophet Joseph Smith.
So in my defense, I was pointing to the essays. I'm not discrediting Joseph Smith. The church's essays are discrediting Joseph Smith. Does that make sense? And I think it's important to talk about those details. It's not, to me, it's not about the image of ex-Mormonism. It's about the truth. And in Mormonism, the truth is not pretty. And you can't get away with that. I mean, Mormons are just going to have to accept that the truth is pretty ugly, but hey, it's the truth. And when you have it, you're liberated. Like, you're empowered to do what you want with it. And that empowerment, that doesn't come from a church. It comes from that information and doing what you want to do with it. So to me, I don't really care what Mormons think about ex-Mormons. I mean, it's not a organized effort. You know, we don't have a PR machine and all that. To me, it's about getting the truth out there and letting them decide what they're going to do with it, what they're not going to do with it.
Thankfully, reality has an anti-Mormon bias, doesn't it?
Yeah. And my point on that, because I think you asked me as well, totally agree with what Jeremy's saying there. First of all, I do have a lot. Thanks for raising Lyndon. I have a lot of respect for Lyndon, a former Belgian Brussels missionary, by the way. I guess my point would be that the church has a bit of an advantage in that they do have a centralized machine. And as you know, the ex-Mormon community is not a centralized machine that way, nor do we necessarily want that. It's about freedom, not about locking us into some other organization. But in terms of, you know, sort of the communications piece, you know, keeping it simple is always important, and narrowing it down. It wouldn't necessarily hurt, for example, on the forums and maybe the ex-Mormon Foundation to have three or four talking points that, you know, seem to be fairly well accepted, that keep it simple. Because I think you noted walking in and just, whether it's a kangaroo court, excommunication court, or otherwise, and just listing off, you know, a list of, things that Joseph Smith did that were horrible and others, I don't think it has a lot of effect. And part of the reasons I talked about immunization yesterday, and I think more and more the church is attempting to immunize its membership, especially its young people, so that it's very much, I've heard this before, it may or may not be true, but the church is still true, and etc. But I think if you have three or four clincher talking points, which might evolve over time, that perhaps resonate a little bit more than others, then I think that's valuable. And certainly one of them needs to revolve around what we've been talking about quite a bit, which is the damage that the Mormon Church and other high-control, high-demand, mild cult-like, as I call them, organizations do in fact do. And it's real. You know, it's not just the broader social issues and public policy, but it's what that leads to, which, as we've seen, sadly, you know, a spike in suicides here in Utah in the last year. And many of them, I think, that, you know, can be linked back to horrible policies like the one that came out last November.
Yeah, to further answer your question, I want to testify that I know that social media is true. And so the power of social media to me is more powerful than a centralized PR machine in most cases. I mean, there's exceptions, of course. So, for example, the narrative is that, you know, ex-Mormons are bitter and angry and all that kind of stuff. So when Ballard came out with his bullshit, where will you go thing, I posted a post where I basically said, I'm going toward more truth, honesty, transparency, love, peace, adventure, loud laughter, kindness, acceptance, empathy, non-judgment, contentment, enough, compassion, courage, and authenticity, away from fear, and all this other negative stuff. So that positive spin is countering that negative perception that they're trying, that the church is trying to paint on it. And this is just social media. I mean, this was shared, and you know, when you share it, all your friends see it, and then, you know what I mean? Like, it has a compounding effect. I would argue that it's not the internet that is destroying the church. It's the compounding effect of the internet plus social media. So, for example, in 2002, when I came home from my mission, I had to know the right questions to ask, the right questions to put into Yahoo. And you know what I mean? Now, Mormons, like chapel Mormons, that have no idea, but they happened to be a friend of somebody that liked my post or John DeLynn's post or whatever, and they see this thing pop up in their face. I mean, I have one friend from my old ward who was a TBM, and he didn't realize that I left, and he just logged into Facebook one day, and that was the same day that I posted about the church's release on the Book of Abraham essay. And he saw LDS.org, and he thought it was okay, and he... And short story is that he's ex-Mormon now. But he had no idea about a Book of Mormon essay, a Book of Abraham essay. He didn't know what to look for. He didn't know the question asked. And social media, which, again, I testify of, you know, that pie of ignorance, the things that you don't know that you don't know? Well, Facebook helps that orange become more green. It's a really powerful effect.
Add to the comments that were made, because this happened pre-internet and I don't know if it's useful anymore. But I need to give you a little content. I was with Mark for 13 years, and in about the ninth year, a bishop had been covering for him. He was singing in the choir, but some general authority called and said, I hear you have somebody in your ward who's, you know, et cetera. And at the time, so Mark said, well, I'm going to go to the excommunication. And I said, well, okay. But I got a hold of the procedures, you know, and I said, I'm going to go there and I will present you. But of course, as they found out that the person that was presenting him was also sleeping with him, they said, wait a minute, we need to call you in this court too. And I mean, they didn't exactly put it that way. But at the time, I realized that while I didn't have full belief in the Mormon Church anymore, while Mark did, I went there, still somewhat of a believer in God and the concepts of Spirit of God. And so I did what I think Mark alluded to. I came there, and instead of being on the attack, I acknowledged that they were the shepherds of the flock, that they were doing something that they were compelled to do, but that also that I believe that they understood that if we approach this right, perhaps we can give room in our hearts to listen with the Spirit in mind. And it was like, boom. But what I had done is I had prepared some comments and some clinchers. And what was so interesting is at the end, I think there was one guy who was like a Boyd K. Packer. He was the first counselor, and he was out of there. And about 11 of the others lined up and shook their hands, and some were crying. And one was a judge, and he said, I will never allow. Oh, I actually shared the story of a seminary student in class. So this is a long time ago in the 90s, and the seminary teacher was basically condoning comments of, well, you know, very anti-gay comments. I didn't tell him, but that boy was my son, and I just shared the story. And it did something. And this judge said to me, you know, I will never, ever allow even such a thing to happen in my forum. So what I'm saying is I took it as an opportunity as best as I could to get them off the defensive and do what I could to educating, acknowledging that they had to do what they had to do. And at the end, the stake president came up and he said, the church needs people like you on high councils and in stake presidencies, and I have to do what I have to do. And that was mind-blowing. So you can always turn it into a platform to make a difference.
So I just want to second the whole idea of the power of social media. The net kind of has provided information, and so all the stuff about the history is there. But then it also provides a way for us to find each other. And finding each other online is awesome, and there's a lot of support. Others see us finding each other, and others see that there's a movement afoot. Everyone in the church knows someone who has left, It's either in their family or a friend or someone from their home ward or what have you. They know
they could not know information. Just the fact that they have loved ones that many times they like personally respect, that alone is extremely more powerful than any.
Just like the gay movement, once you actually knew someone in your life, it was suddenly personal. It was no longer this theoretical kind of thing that you could categorize off. Now it has an impact on your life. So anyway, that was just a comment about what we were discussing earlier. I want to shift the topic really quick. There's a guy named Tyler Glenn who has been really, really pushing the envelope. And basically, he put a red X on his head in trash. He spit on Joseph Smith's image. He showed the temple handshakes all in one video in trash. And now he's come out with another one, Shameless, where he basically humps a man who looks like a general authority. His album is coming out October 21st. It's called Excommunication. So my question is, will they or will they not excommunicate Tyler Glenn? And I'd like everyone who wants to answer that answer.
Maybe they'll make a video of them humping someone that kind of has the semblance of Tyler Glenn. You never know what they're capable of. A little payback.
I have a boyfriend, but I'll volunteer to be the humper. We really, 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 really want Tyler to be in our movie. So if anybody has the ability to contact him, please do. Secondly, speaking to social media, Lloyd, I sent you a Facebook message last night so that, okay, because I couldn't request your friendship.
Oh, well, yeah, I just think that I doubt that they will, because it's going to be just a shitstorm if they do. That'll be in the New York Times. They really want to be in the New York Times again. I mean, come on. But at the same time, if they don't, it just goes to prove that they are moral cowards with absolutely no consistency. And it's absolutely just for their own sick goals why they excommunicate people. So I would be surprised if they do.
I think in any situation like that, what they do in their board meetings is they weigh out the damage that's potentially going to be caused media-wise, New York Times otherwise, by excommunicating someone versus the damage that, or the benefit rather, that they see to, delegitimizing that person and move them out. So they weigh it out, like with John DeLynn and others and Jeremy and that. It took a while, I think. It didn't just happen overnight. Certainly with John DeLynn, it went on for a long time. And no doubt there was all kinds of weighing out process until eventually, right or wrong for them, they, what was best for the corporation, they determined that they would rather take the hit of excommunicating John for the benefit that would be there. And the same thing with the leader of the push for, at some point they deemed it would be beneficial to them. So they really, they do have pros and cons. It's very, no doubt in my mind, it's very corporate. They weigh the potential damage in public opinion and negative publicity versus the benefits to them.
It's a local decision. I'm really fascinated by how this is going to roll out, because unlike the September 6th and John DeLynn and Kate Kelly and all that, Tyler Glenn is not really going after specifically history or doctrinal stuff. He's, from my perception, he's really pissed off over the policy of the November 5th. I could see it. The church is going to go after him. They're gonna beat around the bush and try to find some personal sin, like homosexuality or whatever. It's a really fascinating case. I kind of have my suspicion that Tyler wants to be excommunicated. I'm just speculating here.
So fun. Yesterday when Jeremy was presenting, we remembered that Zelf on the Shelf was trying to excommunicate Jeremy Reynolds before it was cool. We saw it as a really good PR. We're like, if Jeremy would get X, so many people would find out about it. So we sent him a message months ago. And we're like, Jeremy, how would you feel about us starting a campaign to get you excommunicated? And I guess it came to fruition. We didn't even really try that hard. But maybe we could do it with Tyler Glenn, because I think it'd be a big, if we could, maybe we'll get on the Mormon forums and be like, have you guys seen that Tyler Glenn? He needs to go, needs to go. And, you know, start stirring up some problems and get more attention.
I don't
get the New York Times to taunt the church.
That's what we need, yeah.
That's easy. I don't know, like, from my perspective, not just of Tyler, but like my grandmother, my mom's mom is not LDS at all, never has been. She always has a beer in one hand and a cigarette in the other. She's a pretty fun woman and I love her to death. But when I told her about the documentary and I was with my mom at the time, my grandmother literally was like, you need to be careful because they're going to kill you. It might be because she was drunk as shit, which is probably always the case, but like I also... you know, I'm like, if Tyler Glenn is walking the planet, and all of you are, I think I'll be all right.
He needed to go downtown with an umbrella. As soon as John supported ordained women,
that's it.
I mean, 10 years he went. Ordained women, he's gone. Kate's gone. You have to have Tyler sing downtown with a purple umbrella, and then he's gone.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, he has to be all that, plus a Mormon story sign and Mormon thing, and a CS letter and all that.
Wait, so I
have to add the whole thing into the cart.
I know I'm Kate Kelly.
I know I'm sitting up here, but I have a question, I guess. Is it more, is it going to cause more of a ruckus if I choose to get excommunicated instead of resign?
Like, a lot more what?
Like, is it going to cause more of a scene if I choose to go through the process of becoming excommunicated instead of just resigning?
I don't know. The way I see it is that it just depends on, like, if you're worried about how the world perceives you. I mean, if you're excommunicated, it can be kind of a negative thing, like, especially in the Mormon community. So the way I saw it was I wanted to take power in my own hands. I see excommunication being a victimization versus... when you resign, it's an empowerment. So it just depends on how you want
to... I think it depends, too, on how you want to be viewed. Because when internal audience, fair enough. You know, resignation, excommunication have their meanings. Externally, you know, there's not as great an understanding. But, you know, I would suggest that there's that when you're excommunicated, there's that quick question, oh, what did you do wrong?
Yeah.
The answer is probably nothing.
Okay. I think penis.
Yeah.
Okay. So... Okay, well, quickly, I loved your response to the Where Will We Go, and Tanner's was amazing, so if you haven't read that one, you need to read his as well. You know, 8 years ago, the Republican Party seriously underestimated the power of social media, and the Obama campaign leveraged it all the way to the White House. And yes, I used to work as a photographer for the church, and I was part of the PR machine, and they do have that organized PR machine, and that's their biggest disadvantage, because they don't know where to shoot. If we had one organization, they would just aim at that. Now they've got patriots popping up all over shooting at the Redcoats, and they don't know where to shoot. And if we were one organization, they would dehumanize us. We wouldn't be individuals. We would just be a faceless mass that they're aiming at.
Oh, I agree.
So that's the power that the ex-Mormon community has, is we are not organized. They can't just go after one, they go after...
But all I think I was saying is that you need a centralized message supported by centralized talking points. They can come from all kinds of different directions.
Yes,
I agree.
And they continue to give those to us. They just hand them to us. And the things that you write and the things that Jeremy's doing, and the response is every time Fair Mormon goes after Jeremy, they just eat it. You know, so that's, I want to thank every one of you, because you guys are kind of our heroes. And when I struggled for 40 years and thought I was the only one in the world that had the doubts I had, when I found them, it was water in the desert. And it's just gotten better and better and better. And I will go wherever I want.
I'm going to take editorial privilege here. I've been curious, Max, about one thing with you being here this weekend. You basically from what I understand. I mean, you live your life back east, and you've got your family here that brings the ties, but you don't get here all that often, probably, and you were looking forward to this weekend. And I'm sitting here wondering if listening to a lot of trauma, sad stories, but also a lot of good stories, and just the uniqueness of us as a group, does it energize you, or does it depress you to see so many people who've gone through some of the things that you did also?
All I can say right now, Sue, is that I'm overwhelmed, okay? I will be able to answer that question.
Okay. The next book.
I mean, there are parts that sadden me, of course, and there are parts that energize me. The friends I've made here, next year they're going to be old friends. I have that feeling. Not as old as me, but will still be old friends. But right now, it's just such a mix of emotion from having gotten to hear your stories and having my story shared with you. I couldn't separate any of them out and define which was which.
Well, I want to thank everybody who participated this weekend. You know, when you put these programs together, sometimes I'm going just on a hunch, but it feels like a good hunch. And out of all the years, I think I've done maybe 14 of these now. Out of all those programs, I've told a couple people, there's only been two times when I just went, ooh, I shouldn't have done that, you know. But it didn't ruin the weekend. You know, everybody just said, well, you know, people, of course, came to me with their thoughts about it. But I do feel that whatever that spirit is out in the world, whatever drives maybe nothing, maybe it's our collective humanness that's talking to each other all the time, which I do believe. But I think that these conferences have in a way been kind of a landing place and a central, if there is one thing the church could go after and they never have tried, but it's these kinds of things that bring people together, because there's power in numbers, there really are. And that's why the resignations are, you know, that are happening. Or, I mean, I've been told, and I know a lot of you have your ear to the grindstone more than I do because I live in Oregon, but the church is in a panic. And, you know, I don't know. I remember for years we would say, okay, this next guy is going to be a prophet, is younger, so he's going to be different, things are going to happen. But inevitably, by the time they get to be prophet, they're old farts again, you know. But I do think they're going to have to change, and that's all there is to it. And I'm going to end the session now, but you're welcome to stay and talk to them individually. Some people have planes to catch and so forth and so on. So thank you again for your participation.